When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and tonight I am with Sean McKay. How are you doing?
Doing good, Dennis.
Awesome. So it's been a hot minute since you were on the podcast last with the Confined Space Rescue. Would you just refresh our memories about you and what you do?
Yeah, you bet. That was a pre-COVID. That was right before, I think. Right? Yeah. Screwed up all time and space stuff for me. Yeah. So I'm with Element Rescue. I have a background as a firefighter, paramedic, and a team leader on a SWAT team. They left their fire service and law enforcement in 2007 and had been training SOCOM, JSOC, and federal assets since then.
Awesome. Yep. So tonight I want to talk to you about subterranean mobility and rescue, which if you've heard of places that rhyme with schmaza, is a big deal right now. And it's in all kinds of different environments, civilian and operational. But I gotta be honest, I have like zero idea about it. And generally, I stay away from things that I don't know about. So if you could give me a little bit smarter on it, I'd really appreciate it. So kind of what are the realities of going down in the hole?
Yeah, it's probably one of the more, when you think about whether it is civilian or it is operational, it's probably one of the things that if you've had any experience doing it, should raise a bunch of the hair on the back of your neck. Your spidey senses should hit and be like, this could go south quick without a lot of warning. And with that, I think that no matter how good you are, how often you've trained, you're never going to be good enough. You should never feel comfortable enough until you die or that's no longer potentially a mission set for you. Just as an example, we do a lot of trips with groups from assault climbing teams to with PJs. We're just out in Utah with them in a very exposed canyoneering type of thing. And one of the first things I tell them, which doesn't breed a lot of confidence, but they get it hopefully pretty quick, is I tell them every anchor I build is going to fail. And in that, at the end of that day, when we're all back safe, no anchor failures, I consider it fortunate. But the second that I have that level of hubris or believe that I'm that good, and I've been at this location so many times through the years, and I've done releasable anchors off of things that will never hold your body weight and this and that, the second that I believe my own hype or I believe that I'm that prepared for that, is the same time that I'm going to miss a small fire that I could prevent because of a level of hubris. And I think a lot of this comes to a peak when you talk about subterranean tunnels and things like that. There's so many variables that can go awry. And when you say that, what is that? If you put that out for anybody that's listening right now, you know, hey, you know, whether they've had hands-on firsthand experience in a tunnel in a subterranean environment, and you said, okay, get that look. What do you think of when we say subterranean? You have 100 guys, you'll have 100 different thoughts of what their background is, because you never really know. You're going to have something that's kind of maybe you can walk right into mid-mountain type of thing that starts going down before you know it. You're a few hundred feet down. You could have something that you literally have to rappel to get into. It starts off maybe like a kind of a cave entrance, and then kind of starts going horizontal with your ups and downs, with water, with you going under, and then it turns into confined space. The variables are really endless. And so with that, you've almost got to not make any predictions on what you're going to have. And you and I discussed before with some of the technology that's coming out with contracts and things like that within SOCOM to be able to get certain fidelity through the use of drones, even external drones with penetration capabilities, to get some of that landscape depths and things like that to give you a general idea of what you may encounter. But really, it's really important to just kind of go in not trying to predict anything. Know that anything is possible when you get there and have that capability. And on the counter side of that, which makes things really difficult, is when you're moving through there, if you're not doing something that is vehicle assisted for certain areas that sometimes presents itself and you're packing this in, you can't go with that everything in the kitchen sink type of mentality. You still have to remain somewhat fast, somewhat light and operational, but have all those checks covered. And so in it, you really need to know the full capability of the gear that you have, train on it incessantly, and realize new uses for old pieces of gear, and know all those things, which unfortunately isn't probably instructed that well. When we look at like the CASAVAC programs and things like that, it's like, hey, here's a bunch of big pelicans or boxes of shit, man, and here you go. And then people are like, oh, look, lift bags. That's, if I need to lift anything, it's a lift bag. Here's my Halmatra. If I need to cut or spread a vehicle, that sounds about right. Then that's what will be my vehicle, my grinder, vehicle. Sawzall, yeah, I guess some other, but mainly just cutting some shit on a vehicle, maybe a post, B post. When in reality, you can lift psychotically heavy things with nothing but a high lift jack that's on your mobility kit, and you do it way faster and way quicker because you're never, you know, you look at it, you're like, well, a high lift jack is a 4,800 pound, you know, lift capability. Well, you're never lifting the whole thing.
Right.
You're cribbing and you're lifting an edge. And you're cribbing, you're lifting an edge. And so at no point are you even coming close to maxing this out, and be amazed at the weight of some objects. We have done nothing but literally get a purchase point with the Halmatra, right? If it's on the dirt, we're going to put some wood under there so it doesn't sink down into the dirt and not lift, right? Hit that Halmatra, get a purchase point where I can get a rescue high lift jack, the first responder high lift jack in there. And you're done before somebody's even got their bags hooked up to the air yet. Very fast, very quick. And having to sustain that capability of knowing how to work a high lift jack is psychotically easier than working bags or cushions when that comes to it. So knowing the capabilities of everything that you have and knowing how to use things, I don't want to say off label because it gives an appearance of it being a little sketchier, not as safe. Which is not the case, you know, especially like with the high lifts and things like that. But knowing how to exploit every piece of kit that you have available and find secondary uses for that. And as a medic, most of you guys, you know, we do that already, knowing that, right? And we always have to, we never have everything that we need, and we feel comfortable improving. And that's going to be so key in even being able to enter and access into a subterranean, let alone move and then potentially deal with a casualty.
Right.
Package and then extract. It can be a little nightmarish.
So, I mean, when I think of, you know, going down into a tunnel system or a cave system or what have you, so anything subterranean, you know, my first thought is, you know, structural collapse. You know, there's a big difference between having a tunnel that was inspected by, you know, whatever municipality and deemed safe, and you're in some third world country where a guy took a spade to the mountainside and tunneled in, you know, miles. So, you know, like, how do you even begin to assess, like,
so to be honest with you, it goes a little bit deeper. And with that, we're known for kind of doing rescue very differently than a lot of other groups, and doing what on the surface may seem like, oh, dude, like, that's super sketchy, until we show them the nonlinear science of how safe it actually is with it. And we're able to do that because if we would do nothing but, you know, study what anybody, any book has ever written on vertical stuff or collapse stuff or whatever, we're going to be just as good as whoever wrote that book, who's probably maybe not that awesome, maybe awesome in one context, but not the context we're talking about from an operational standpoint, right? If we had every asset in the world known to man, and we have unlimited fire trucks to bring in, right? Maybe that would suffice, but that's not the case. And so you kind of got to know the rules, the principles, those key forged principles of what is required, and figure out how you can make that happen. It's a very complex problem, but we can't bring complexity into complexity and expect ourselves to thrive. We're going to fail every single time. And so being able to simplify those areas that we can simplify and go after that is absolutely key. So when we look at it, what helps us out to be able to do those things that people are like, dude, that I thought that would be impossible to do or whatever, is one, we tinker.
Yeah.
Right. We tinker so nobody gets hurt, but I don't know, man, can we lift this, you know, 30,000 pound thing that has a mannequin under the, like, what if we only had a high lift jack? Like, what would we do then? Like, let's just see. Sure. And from that you learn, okay,
yes,
this sucked, this was the problem, but what if we were able to raise it with the Halmatra? What if we were able to literally just use a lever and a fulcrum from parts of the collapsed building to get it up far enough? And then all of a sudden it becomes like, you know, I always tell people, like, I take what I do really serious. I don't take myself serious. So when we're trying to solve a problem, I'll fail 100 times in front of you. But it's like that 101st time that becomes like a multi-cam panty remover. You're like, oh my God, I don't even know how that worked. Like, let's try it again. But tinkering is really important to be able to always be pushing yourself in training and taking stuff away. And that produces an anabolic response by adding stressors, taking stuff away, than just doing what we always do. Hey, what do? We always lift that thing up with these bags. I don't know. Let's just do that. That's very catabolic, right? What's the chances you ever having to run into that exact thing? Like a million to one. It's never going to happen. Right. So always trying to exploit every piece of equipment that you may have on target or on scene is vital. So for us, knowing material science and these is what allows us to understand that interaction, where a lot of people don't go into that because it's boring and I've got ADHD and I don't sleep, so I got nothing else to do. And so that's really what helps keep a lot of things that we can push innovation. And in that type of thing, I could say one of the biggest things anybody could do is literally just pull up the freaking geology.
Yeah. Okay.
That's it. You know, so when you're seeing things that are granite, you're seeing versus sandstone, or you're seeing shale, like, problematic. You're going to have certain geology that's going to lend itself to not being awesome with weight bearing the further down you go, with a higher potential for collapse. You're going to have certain areas that have underground aquifers and things like that are going to keep things moist and soft and problematic in certain areas that you got to be really cautious of. And then how do we plan up against that? And in the end, right, any piece of equipment you should have, right, we should always run it through that, you know, primary, alternate, contingency, emergency type of thing of what can I do if I start seeing this piece collapse or that piece collapse, or I start hearing stuff drop into the water behind me and it's like, crap, my egress is going away. But to be honest with you, and I'm not saying go get your PhD in geology. I'm saying just know a little and look it up when you pull that up. For those areas that you're going into, is probably one of the most vital things that you can do to help yourself out, even if you got to dig yourself out.
Right. just being observant as you're entering in, do you see cracks, you know, loose material? It's probably a good indicator that this is not a, at least this particular spot is not super stable.
Exactly. Exactly. Cool. And you just know that the properties of that rock or the formation, the dirt and things in that area. You know, I was just out with on the West Coast, and you know, those anchors that we're building out in San Diego with NSW, very different than around here. You know, that red clay, love that red clay. Yeah. I mean, that's some thick ass stuff. I mean, I can just put a knife in the ground, clove hitch it, and I can send two people off on that thing as an anchor. Gonna have to be a little bit more inventive when you're rappelling off into the Pacific Ocean or something like that on that sand. And so just knowing that the general behavior and always predict for it's not going to be how you want it. That sand is not going to be hard packed, that it's going to be flailing around. There's going to be shale around. There's going to be this and that. That's just going to clump off underneath you. It's huge, and just plan for that worst case contingency, if you will. But to be honest with you, geology plays a huge role in that. And a lot of the videos and a lot of the AERs that we work with people on when they've done subterranean work, that's whether it's tunnels or is this like subterranean obstacle course, some of these things look at, it end up being right off the bat. We can kind of look at that before they ever even, the video even goes into that area, and be able to tell what that behavior is pretty rapidly and what you can expect to go wrong, if it will, fairly rapidly, just from a geology standpoint.
Okay. Yeah, perfect. What about things like visibility? Now, you know, you have, you know, civilian rescue. You can bring in as much lights and power as you possibly can squeeze down that hole. Some different environments, you probably don't want to shine a flashlight. So, like, how do you even handle that situation?
Right. Yeah. And you obviously, we talked about before too, there's certain environments that don't lend itself well to night vision. And so when you get there, you know, a lot of times when you go down into a lot of them is you almost have this very thick dust fog that's in there also with you. So to couple that, I would say, yeah, the vision's a problem, but it compounds it when you have respiratory issues also. So when you're having to put on some sort of respiratory protection that's in there, or how far can I go before I need to kind of back out? And, you know, you don't, if it's one of those ad hoc type of we just stumbled on this and we gotta see what's going on, or we're chasing something into this area, we have whatever, wasn't necessarily completely planned. We don't have SCBAs, we don't have PAPRs, we don't have certain things like that. Then we need to come up with a capability for that. And it could be nothing more than, you know, as a medic, throwing a Nonin pole socks on you and, hey, you know, where am I? Here, I'm at the opening. And yeah. Once it goes, like, I'm going to probably start backing out of here. Obviously, there's some ways that you can rate the end titles with a mask too that you can keep on and watch that in real time too for an end title. But you've got to get inventive and you got to improvise those type of capabilities, because I will say there's been plenty of times people have gone in not realizing how deep they were before they had huge problems because of displacement of oxygen in their bodies.
Yeah, absolutely. Which kind of leads me into my next point. Not even just, you know, you're down in a confined space, you can just, you being present, you can use up the oxygen in the room, but also you have different gases coming through the soil. You have different gases coming off of the water. Equipment I'm using is giving off gases. You know, if we're in a fight or something like that, the fire causing gases or consuming gases, like, this is a crazy mess.
Oh gosh, it's rough, you know. And it's one of those things where if there is a potential for you being in an area that you may have to not a planned mission set, but that you may have to encounter that and go into something that could lead itself into a subterranean or an oxygen depleted area. And you're right, besides oxygen depleted, just other gases that can go in there organically is really problematic. So being able to have some sort of detector, and they've gotten really good at really small ones that just hit the major ones that'll start kind of beeping off, and hopefully you have a silence on that you can, you know, if that's what you're kind of doing, so you're not like, you know, making a lot of noise like a firefighter in there. Just pre-planning that. And I think it also goes back to this is that, and this is one of the I don't know, things I bitch about the most. We wrote about it in the operational, like the vertical manifesto that we put out last year. But at the beginning of the vertical manifesto, we said, we say vertical, but this is for any kind of rescue type of thing, is the way that many of us and SOCOM, you know, DOD as a whole, but SOCOM has to do like these risk assessments for mission sets. And the problem with that is, by definition, when we do those, by definition, to do a risk is to get a probability, which means all of your knowns, your contingencies, variables, and options are known. Yeah. It's the only time you can do a risk, yep, by definition, right? Otherwise, it isn't. So when you think about what civilians are forced into, feds are forced into, all of these things with risk assessment forms, 99% of that is a wag. It's a wild ass guess, you know, but you have to fill it out. Right. And right. So, you know, I always go back to, you know, JJ, right, with the exposure at the CCP in Syria that, you know, done podcasts on and stuff like that with a couple different ones. And you ask him like, well, you know, if you had, you know, on your risk assessment, what was your probability, right? What did you gauge as your probability, your risk of having mustard in warheads that would compromise your CCP, right? And get the five of you so dicked up that you're still having your own problem now. It could be zero or it could be 100, right? You literally lie to yourself. You try and use best judgment, but there's too many unknowns. So yep, it no longer meets the capability of doing risk. And so on that, you have to do uncertainty, right? And what's funny is uncertainty and risk are handled completely different. And this is my huge gripe, because I've had to fill out hundreds of risk assessment things for mission sets and operations and stuff like that. And I just didn't understand it as much then. I knew it was bullshit that whatever I was writing down, right? But I didn't understand it, you know, and, you know, until like 15 years ago when I like started digging into it. There's a guy, Gerd, who's out of the Planck Institute, who is pretty much the leading expert in uncertainty and how to manage uncertainty. And uncertainty is literally when you don't know all of the variables, knowns, and all that stuff, which is pretty much like 99% of what you're going to run into. Whether
sounds
you're
like
you're
life civilian, to me,
that's pretty much life. You're exactly correct. And so what's interesting though is there's heuristics, and I'm not going, let's not go to like Daniel Kahneman and Tversky battling other people about the negativity of heuristics, and this is deliberate heuristics that are well thought out. And as a medic, what's funny is we use heuristics a lot more than we think we do. And I can tell you, anybody that's an EMT or a medic, you know, it knows one heuristic right off the bat that I can't even finish before people will finish it for me, is okay. Any female between the ages of 13 and these ages change sometimes 13 to 42 with abdominal pain is an ectopic until proven otherwise, right? That's a heuristic, right? So you're always going to that worst case scenario. But if we're JJ then, and we've talked about this a bunch, is okay, like what's the chance of it? Who knows, dude? Like we don't know. So it's uncertain. So let's just say this, from the most covert presentation of mustard to the most heinous looking textbook version, if you've got a blister, you're mustard until proven otherwise.
Yep.
right? That's a heuristic, right? And so we're going to have to learn to deal with reality. So even if you got to fill out something on a risk within your team, understand how to mitigate uncertainty. And I'll drop some cheat sheets off that I have that'll have some stuff on that Gerd wrote. He's brilliant. He's got some great books, but he's really that leading expert in the world on dealing with uncertainty and separating that. And what's funny is you're like, well, it's probably a new thing. That's why the military or the civilian side, you know, that runs higher risk, high consequence type things haven't caught on to this. That's not the case. It was first written by this guy, Frank, is his last name, Frank, in 1924. So it's been out since 1924, Dennis, right? So it's funny, right? That like we've known uncertainty and risk cannot be handled the same way. And so out of that, I think I found that very helpful for even when you do a trip out to Italy with a climbing team or Utah or anything, that's how we do our plans. Is based on those, and it becomes second nature pretty quick on what you have available, and it's going to come automatic to you guys, because even if you didn't do that in your pre-planning, you're doing it ad hoc in the problem, and so once you have a framework of how to operate that thing, it presents itself and makes things a lot clearer. So going all the way back around to what you're saying, and with that is I think getting a good accurate assessment of all the variables and when those variables intertwine of what could go wrong, that planning is so freaking critical. And we can't just like take a template and just start marking it down for anything. But when you get into that sub key, you have so many variables, and we talked about some of them, right? There's a good chance I may have some vertical shit that I've got to do in there. Well, what's your rope made out of, right? How does that environmental pathology? So as a whole, let's just call what you're going to deal with in there, your environmental pathology, right? It's stuff that can hurt you, right? Whether it's a human shooting at you, whether an explosive going off, whether it's fumes coming off of water with decayed shit in it and this and that, and what it's bat shit all over the damn place in a cave or whatever the crap may be. And those things that will absolutely kill your equipment, you know, and that's what kind of kills me is when you think about like Seaburn type of operations, you know, which is, you know, not just a problem set for this. You know, I've been with Fifth Group and some other groups that have been training on this that's had that, you know, thrown in their lap. And they're like, oh, thank you. Yeah. You know, can I have another? It's such a hard problem, but you know, if you think about, okay, there's going to be a vertical area that we're doing in this area that potentially has chemical threat in it, which is why I'm wearing an SCBA and in this area. But what's interesting is if you look at the typical ropes and the harnesses that you're wearing, maybe somewhere between 15 to 35 seconds for what we found before your harness is jello. Like if you're rappelling, let's say down, you've got to make an access and you're going through whatever, some sort of shaft or whatever. And that may be 200 feet down. That means you're only going to fall probably 185 feet at that point. So that's okay. And that could be your harness or it could be your anchor that's up there, because most of it's going to be webbing, which will deteriorate. The same thing. Polyester, same nylon polyester, which is that, right? We can get more voodoo with some of our fibers and things like that and ropes, but it doesn't really matter if your anchor gives out of your harness, because that's your fast roping on an 8mm is not a thing, and you're going to splat and crater hard. So the material science of what you're even taking in with you becomes very critical. So you know, the aid bags that you're going in, and you know, is your stuff that did you go through and take the time and use 5mm, you know, which is good for chem, it's good for salt water and stuff like that, to vacuum seal those things in there? Is your shit just going to get super saturated because you threw your aid bag on and went in? So much of that is prepped. If you can think worst case scenario, left to bang, is what's going to save a lot of that heartache. So, you know, geology, it's the potential for a collapse. What do you have to potentially start digging your way back out, digging your way into, right? Has happened in a couple situations, right? A couple BJs you can talk to that'll tell you how fun that is digging into to make access. So, you know, what we pretty much do is a guy named Ryan Galdez, who was an assault medic, a good friend of mine, when he got out, we saw people going onto various mission sets, sub-T, tunnel systems, vertical stuff, complex rescues, and grabbing everything that was in a CASEVAC box and just throwing it on there because we don't know what we're going to need, which isn't the answer, but there's never really a good framework. And so we tried to put together a framework, and I'll send you this PDF too, if you can post that and anybody can download any of these cheat sheets to help with their planning, or at least it's stuff you've already thought about, but it may be a couple things that'll remind you or key something else up in your head, so you don't get the operational sucker punch where you're like, I totally, that flipped through the crack. I can't believe I forgot about that. And so we kind of broke it into like these four pillars of casualty management, but in reality, it's kind of four pillars for any kind of response. And if you take a casualty, it works out well for that too. But we kind of broke it in, and it's kind of the access before anything, we get to that casualty, or we need to get into an area that contains something that we need to grab. We have to access it. So it's the same if, you know, I have a patient that's in an overturned MRAP, like I better have a way of getting into that MRAP and doing that. If it's somebody, you know, that's deep into a cave, you know, in cave, a waterfall type of thing that I've got to rappel down to be able to access and get to them, realizing that clock in that window of opportunity to potentially do some good and prolong them having a heartbeat, it doesn't start by the time I get to them, right? It's already started. So the more efficient and smooth I can get and choreograph what that looks like, the better it is to be able to access and get to them. So access is that first, then assess and stabilize, which is for most of your listeners is going to be the bread and butter. But there's a big gray area in there that's based on your environmental pathology, the threat, right? Whether that is from an oxygen depleted area, or that is somebody's trying to shoot you, or there's IEDs, or there's whatever, there's that gray area where that may be a really rapid assessment, and I'm just doing enough that hopefully they're not going to die as I'm trying to get them out, right? Because we know that every modality, every treatment modality that I do adds further complexity in trying to move them and package them and not having it get ripped out and things like this. And so, I may have all the time in the world, with no threat, and I can do everything I wanted to, or you're going to be really monitoring that patient. And it's those things that a little bit of cheats come in handy. I don't even have my background here, but like I've got these like glow tapes on the ends of my windlass on these cats, and people are like, like, so you can see it? And I'm like, no, not so I can see it. But it's so if I'm coming down a vertical plane or I'm moving a casualty through a confined area, I know how that sits. And as soon as that windlass pops out, I can see it when they're 20 feet up in the air coming down to me, whether it got slanked on something and that windlass is off in there, you know. So you're never going to see good enough. You're never going to be any of this stuff. So small little cheats here and there just to be able to be able to look down at that casualty as you're trying to haul them through like a quick 2-to-1 through a confined space and be like, oh shit, man, like that's not how their windows should be. It should be like this. It's like this and flopping around. And I can see that with glow tape, or I can see that with whatever. And just priming it, kidding yourself out and just making it like really doing user interface, user-centered design, and your context is rough. So being able to make those pieces of kit more intuitive for the way you're going to use it. And I was going to talk more about that later, but all that stuff is left to bang, and all that stuff is what's going to help more and train on it. And then where did you make mistakes? Document it. All right. How can I change this piece of equipment so I can pick up on that earlier? What I can do with this, or, you know, what are those signs of moving past an area that's safe to maneuver. So assess and stabilize, very quick, very fast. You've got to be the top of your game on that. And now comes the packaging and extraction. And yeah, packaging that person the right way based on their injuries and your modalities. And we always look at injuries, but we don't always think about modalities. And it wasn't really until I was doing a bunch of perfused cadaver stuff with some feds that I realized how many terrible, terrible bad habits we learn doing patient movement, whether it's vertical, confined space, out of a vehicle, whatever, with mannequins.
Yep.
It was amazing how many things I wanted. I literally was probably vomiting in my own mouth along with everybody else with the sounds of them maneuvering a cadaver out the way that they have muscle memory, a mannequin. And so being able to package them really effectively, and you got somebody that got stitched through that has a unstable pelvis. You're coming out of a confined area, and you'd love to keep them horizontal, but that's just, like, the environment has a lot of say on everything you do. You could want two or three anchor points. You could want this. You could want that. Doesn't mean shit. The environment gives you what it gives you. And you better be able to adapt and think about it. And so different ways you can, whether it's in a regular skit or a PJ skit, on how you can cone that in so tight around their hips to where even when you go into a vertical area, that motion isn't going to be an axial load into their hips, right? Yep. Being able to take that rope and put a stopper mount on the inside of it before you hook it onto the outside, that way you don't gain all that extra that always happens whenever you do that, right? Yep. There's so many little cheats that you can do, but you have to screw up every way possible before you can become, right? And so you'll understand, like, okay, I'd love to do this, but we're going in a tight-ass area. If we package them, we're getting them out. Like I said, there's going to be times if we have any pelvic involvement and things like this, like, we're just going to make it 10 times worse potentially as soon as they axial load down there. Well, how can I package somebody differently? How can I rig that system differently? And you'd be amazed at how unscientific rigging a SCEDCO actually is when you look at the data. If we say we want to do, that's kind of my problem too, is if I came to you and said, hey, listen, man, I get all your data-driven, evidence-based crap, Dennis, man, but I really think, like, we may think about maybe going back to, like, I'm a big fan of, like, rolling tourniquets for CHF. And you're like, dude, I don't even know what the hell you just said, bro. Like, isn't that like 1800s? And I'm like, yeah, I don't have it. That's what we do in rescue.
Uh-huh.
Right? You're going to get thrown off stage with medicine. Like, where's the data? Where's your studies? Where's your empirical research? Right. Where's this research? Where's that? But on rescue, people just throw shit out. And thank God we're making a move away from that. But most 99% of the people that you rescue have never even heard of those movements that are going on now. But, like, if I'm rigging you up and I'm taking you off a 300-foot cliff in Moab doing a rescue on you, like, you could die. Like, and that's kind of the thing. Well, medicine's a thing. You give the wrong drug, you give the wrong dosage, you could die. But anything in rescue, you could die too, bro. You know, so why aren't we putting that same stringent criteria on testing and evaluating all these things to test the validity of it? And it wasn't until probably 8-10 years ago that we realized, like, a shit ton of stuff that was gospel, don't even question it, and vertical stuff was completely theoretical and got proven completely wrong. And now it's blended over into all the other disciplines of rescue. So it's a really pretty cool, exciting time. And once you smell blood in the water, everybody's testing everything, and it gets worse because you realize all these things that you thought were the gospel, it had no foundation to them whatsoever. And in that, being able to improv that, try shit out, just play around and try shit out that matches the flow of your team. Are you moving fast and light? Are you a little bit more deliberate? What are you doing? And make sure that those rescues go in there. And if they don't gel, work it, man. Like, everybody listen to this is smart. Like, you can figure some shit out. You can put a mannequin in, so if it drops 40 feet off a tower, like, don't do that, right? No harm, no foul. Mannequin's still fine, right? But work it out, figure it out, and learn the intricacies of that system and how things work. figure out all those other things that you can use. Like, what can we use? Like, if we do start having this come down, I'll give you one example. Is back in the day, I already brought up Jay Johnson's name, who's now Dr. Johnson, I guess. Ginger, phenomenal dude, like phenomenal medic, doctor, everything now. But I remember him hitting me up at like 2 or 3 in the morning. He's like, "Hey, you ever heard of a Carez?" I'm like, "Nope." He's like, "All right, I'm gonna send you some pictures. Like, we got an issue. What this is what they have here. You know their mobility piece. What can we do to get somebody that fell into one out?" Right. And at that point there were some houses that were being built over some holes. Dudes going in under an NVG, kicking a door, going yep. and falling. And so one of those things is we came up with some ad hoc things, but we ended up finding these pyrotechnics, these gold struts. These struts hold up like psychotically huge buildings. It holds up like load bearing walls and you know, collapse things or whatever. They make them and they're really quick to put up, and they make a one that fits in your just in any trailer hitch. Boom, put it up and it's a gin pole, right? A single pole. Tie it back with two pieces of webbing. It takes literally 35-45 seconds to rig the whole thing up. Extend it. That's it. Tie it back. Send it down. You got a high anchor. You can go right over. Bring them right up. Boom. And it takes 45 seconds of prep time. You train on it once every 3 years and you aren't going to forget it. Like, it's that easy to do. And then as we're getting into it, because they're getting these for the Carez problems that they're running into, and they collapse down to where it fits in a razor, no problem. It's very easy and it's lightweight as hell. What's crazy about it is the safety factor on those things for holding up like 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 pounds is like huge safety factor. It's ridiculous. So once you start going into something, maybe with tunnels that you can get vehicles into or anything like that, that's the perfect opportunity now where you have these already. They're lightweight. You extend them out, put an extension on it, not put an extension on it, whatever, you extend it. There's even a little air thing where an air bottle, where if you need the pressure to push something back up, you just take your already existing air bottle to and it doesn't even, like, the training on it's so simple to use. Like, it not even 1/100th of trying to remember how to work an airbag system. So simple to use, but now we have another use for it. Then we found another use for it. And then we found another use for it. And those are the things you really want to look for. And, you know, if you have anything that you can think about creating from a collapse, if you look at it, I didn't realize until we were doing some stuff for HRO with after the Fukushima incident, that literally in Japan, a lot of people, because of earthquakes and all, they reposition their furniture away from the wall. So in an earthquake, they can go to that load bearing wall and always have a crawl area, a place to jump into. So they literally have the furniture in their homes around the potential for an earthquake and collapse items in there. Yep. And if you think about the same thing, you don't need a lot. You just need something to be able to crawl through. So if I'm looking at something that's a load bearing wall where that collapse is probably going to be on something unsupported. Right. And, you know, now granted you could have a bunch of different things, but you know, if I can find that wall where this is probably the most likely area, if we can keep something not even that big along there that gives us some sort of stabilization where it's not going to collapse into, we can improvise something. And I think that you have to think, I hate the word think outside the box, but you have to think non-linear, non-Euclidean in your things of different uses for things that are already going to be there. And what can we make happen? And even if it makes it slightly easier, it will pay dividends in the end. And I kind of, you know, but the extract and all that is something that we got to think about, how we package them, and then the evac piece. And I have a whole thing kind of written up on there, whether you're a federal team or you're SOCOM, that kind of at least gives you a framework that you can then build assets into without going overboard.
Sure.
And understanding, hey, like, this is out of all these things, these are the potential threats I'm going to deal with. How am I going to mitigate these? How many of those can be mitigated by the same damn thing? And it's all really nonlinear physics, to be honest with you. Bar Yam from the New England Complexity Science Institute wrote a great paper on multi-scale requisite variety. And that's really what we do.
Yeah.
A lot of words.
Yeah. So like all this coordination and, you know, teamwork, moving to the patient, assessing the patient, evacuating the patient out of whatever place you are in, all of those things require communication. I don't believe, I was never a COMO person, but I don't think they purpose-built radio equipment to go through rock and dirt and concrete. So I could imagine you can talk to each other because you're, I don't know, a few feet away. But how do you talk to topside when you're like, I need those extendable poles. I need this type of gear that was either unplanned for, that we didn't think was going to happen, but now we need it. Or it was too big for us to get into at the moment. Now is the time to move this piece of equipment forward, type of thing. So, I mean, are you running cables or sending a runner?
I would have to say interpretive dance. I would just do interpretive dance. Yeah, that's it. That's nothing in this. As I think you, all your listeners are rapidly seeing, is like, there is no easy solution to anything in here.
Yeah.
And what's crazy is we talked before, seeing vision, right? My MVG is not working great in here. I don't want to use white light. But now couple that with, I also am in an area that with contaminants in the air that I need to put a PAPRT on, like that just, that isn't, I doubled the problem. That's an exponent. Yeah. It's a magnitude of order worse. Now you cover communication on top of that. And you're like, what the fuck, man? Seriously. Like, it's like, I just got kicked in the balls. And when I looked up with tears in my eyes, like you poked my eyes and then somebody squirted lemon juice in it and then threw salt in it. And I'm like, is there something else? And then you're like, oh, paper cut on your eye. That's really where these events can go. If you think about it too, we don't have a robust amount of TTPs that are out there because it's not as common as you hitting CQB, you hitting the building, you hitting this and that. Especially as you get into, you know, more of your chemical and stuff, right? Like crap. So never stop short of all the things that could go wrong and trying to problem solve that. So a lot of that's going to be a little different depending on your organic assets. And so one thing I wanted to say in here is, you know, there's never one way of doing anything, right? Whether we're talking comms, we're talking vision, we're talking anything like that, there's no way of doing that rescue. Anybody that says, you know, hey, what would be the best way to do a rescue if I was underground and this and this? And if somebody answers you, I probably wouldn't listen to anything else they say, because the answer should be, well, it depends. And then they should ask you about 15 other questions and say, okay, just with what you said, I would say maybe this, but if you change any one of those variables, the answer would probably be different. And that's the nonlinear complex problem that you are putting yourselves into. And that being said, there is no best practice because you change one variable, that best practice, there is no best practice for that. You create the best practice in real time and it's for that event. It's probably not the best practice for me going somewhere in another country doing the same thing because it's going to be different. The geology will be different. This will be different. The threat will be different. So in it, there's not that template that one size fits all. And, you know, that the best way you can do it is satisficing. I think it was Herbert Simon back in the day put, you know, that term, put suffice and satisfy, and, you know, came up with that satisficing. We have to feel content that it's never going to be the perfect thing. Hindsight will always bring in other things. Armchair quarterbacks will always come in with bullshit, whatever. In the end, what we do and how we do it is dependent on things. And I will tie it back into your question. Based on your individual team, your level of training and experience, right? And how hard you push yourselves into contingencies, CCIRs, all these type of robust things, your organic assets, which is not just what you bring in you, but your manpower and personnel, level of people? Are you a small party? Do you have more assets coming in? Do you have somebody you can pull in that was a QRF now coming in to assist? Your threat, your environmental pathology, right, is going to play a huge role in that. And then your mission segment, what part of that mission is it hitting on, that problem, that friction point hitting on? Is it early on, right? Is it, you know, and if you catch a really bad problem early on, that's a tough one, man, right? Unless you train all the fucking time, you know. And I always have to give out, I lost a good friend of mine, Josh Wheeler, in 2015, who's actually the first climbing team guy I ever worked with, was him and Alex. You know, the medic Danny, that was explosive breach he was in on me, went in. And so it was at the very first part of that huge hostage rescue, right? It was the largest hostage rescue in the history of JSOC. And Danny had him in the air like 16 minute mark. Yeah. But that's because they train like king beasts, always going like, all right, let's make it worse.
Right.
And there's a lot to that, right? It's like, okay, I have all the assets I need. Now none of the fucking assets I need. And I think that's how we always have to kind of approach that across that entire spectrum of that. So just mission segment, what part of that mission is it hitting in? What's your flow? How quickly are people moving? How far can people back out to assist? And really your current trending. So, you know, are we trending? Shit's going bad. It's been, okay, our comms, our vision's turned to shit. Now I'm working off headlamps, but we don't want to use white light, but fuck, I can't see anything else. The white light's glazing off this dusty fog that's already underneath there. So, you know, what does red look like? What does green look like? You know, can I see freaking my hand in front of my face? And then now, like, people are starting to cough. Pulse ox are going, like, we're trending in a really bad direction. So that is, those solutions are going to be much more hasty with a primary of like, we're going to, like, that's the CCI, like, the mission now is not the mission. Now the mission is to get everybody out type of thing. So my point in saying all that is, with more assets, when we do confined space, partial collapse, if we're not too deep into, let's say, a building, which is going to be way easier than way down into a subterranean area, we'll stagger, right? A lot of times it's our spider monkeys that are going in. They can get through tight areas. They can get through these things. So when they're trying to, you know, even cut to get through an area, dig out to get through an area, they're smaller or whatever. And then we kind of stack. So the bigger hosses are outside. So when there's a rope or something that they need to pull, like, that's the dude I want pulling type of thing. So kind of the right person for the right circumstance, right? If I'm going down a couple of, like, a partial floor collapse and I got a guy down there, like, I'm not sending 320 pound guy in full gear that can, like, break doors open with his head and stuff like that. You're hauling us up, man. I'm sending skinny guy down, and that's his packaging. And then, you know, then it's easier for us to get them and the casualty out. So right person for the right job is a big thing on some of these, if you're afforded that luxury. Is getting that in, having some sort of rope, even if it's not vertical, to be able to be kind of tagged in, also isn't too bad of an idea for finding an escape, finding somebody that was in there. But from a communication standpoint, a lot of times having those people that are within some sort of yelling distance, or if we're close enough that we can hit to hear around that corner and the outside is probably worst case scenario, something that you have to consider where you're going to stage assets. And those assets are, if you're bringing somebody out of that area, it's going to be one of those cases, man, where by the time you get them to this position, like, you could very well be fucking done, man. Like, you need to hand off, and they're like, I got it from here. And we saw that right in Thailand, right? In the cave rescue also, where it was a handoff piggyback type of exfil.
Staged approach.
That's it. Thinking you're going to be the one that has them from in there through all the, literally a casualty extraction obstacle course.
Yep.
Is what it's going to feel like. And a lot of times, you know, I always tell people, you know, whether when I'm moving somebody through a confined space, a lot of times it's really tight, especially when you're dealing with kit and shit like this. It's like, when can you ditch kit too, right? There's a time where you're like, it's almost more hazardous to keep your plates on, to keep certain things on, than and the potential for getting it snagged and stuck on things is huge, especially in a collapse situation, man. And the way that some of these places are put together is crazy. But if I'm moving you out, either you, me, or both of us will be pregnant by the time we get out. We're that close. Like it's like biblical type of thing. Like, because of you're all over them and you're trying to get them around this corner and through this and that. Can I keep their head above water? How do I, you know, how do I cover their mouth to get them under and up, back up and in a, you know, certain case situation. So, in the end, what people need to realize is there's no rules.
Yep.
Right. And there's no TTPs that are already written. It's principles, forge principles.
Yep.
And then off those principles, you create the best practice for that specific incident at that specific time with that threats and your assets in there. And I wish there was a rotisserie chicken, set it and forget it type of thing. Hey, dude, it's easy. This is how you do it. Right. Yep. And I can say that, right, for one specific thing. And then, hey, go out and try this at this place with these things, or I'll do a training. I can set up all those variables. So you're like, dude, this is easy as shit. Except when you do it in real life, it's going to be terrible. Right. And unfortunately, you got to be careful with who you choose for training. Because the training groups can, and this is seen, I come from the fire service. You see this in the fire service. I've been through shit tons of training for a lot of years where things are set up in such a way that, you know, at the end you're like, but what if, dude, like, what if that happened? Like, well, that's probably pretty rare. Okay. So you're saying you're putting a probability to something that's nonlinear, which you can't, that doesn't meet the criteria. It's an inverse power law, but we'll fucking over. Thank you. And we set ourselves up with this false sense of security that, which sucks. And so the second you feel secure, with your response, you need to rethink, the variables that you're inputting into it and what you really will have available. But I think out of anything, when you texted me about this, I'm like, holy crap. Yeah. If there's one thing that I think I would want to convey to people is that not only are you not ready for this, you won't ever be ready for it.
Yep.
So let that drive your training and get sadistic. And once you don't solve all the problems at one time, break it down into small pieces and then see how those interact and what difference that made for, and training time is a commodity, man. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to work with some organizations that are afforded large budgets and unbelievable training. And you ask them and they're like, it's not enough.
Yep. It's never enough.
It's never enough, you know? And, so even if it's just hanging around a team room, throwing shit out there, throwing shit problems in. And I think if it's one thing that, I insanely admire, with various organizations that I'm fortunate enough to work with, is when they actively, aggressively seek to find their weaknesses or their gaps. Yep. Like when they're out there like, hey, it went well in that training, but if we would have done this, what would we have done? Like they're seeking, trying to find any chink in their armor.
Yep.
And that's really what defines you. Once you get comfortable with going, hey, let's train hard as fuck. Let's make it really tough. And let's try new shit in training. So if it doesn't work, like we know it doesn't work, right?
Yep.
And if we did find something that worked that we're like, holy shit, dude, like high five, right on that one. That was pretty cool. The next thing should only be to find when it's going to fail.
Right.
because, you know, it's Halev, right? The turkey's stoked, you know, 400 days in a row. That thing's getting fed every day. He's like, this shit's awesome. On the 401st day, he gets his head chopped off and he's on your table at Thanksgiving last month, right? It's like, it's more important. It's more critical what you don't know than what you do know.
Yep, absolutely.
And I think you can't really say that more than talking any kind of subterranean or tunnel, let alone if you're, you know, part of a 4th Battalion or something like that, that's doing, getting into chem bio type of stuff. There are so many psychotic environmental pathologies that will smoke you down, and they're robust.
Yep.
And what sucks is it's not just somebody shooting at you, right?
Yep.
It's 50 other things at any given time could go awry. And, you happen to freaking get dizzy, trip, and you crack your mask.
Yep. Done.
What are we doing, right? The hot mask changeover? Or what do you do? Do you have an extra mask down here? Do you have an extra mask on a RIT pack? I mean, you can just go down and down and down all these things. And but I think that's exciting, right? I think that's good. That's all we do is try and find, we're fortunate enough to be able to co-collaborate with incredible fucking people to find solutions. Sometimes the problems that mission's never happened before. And turn around and be like, all right, how's that going to fail? And where am I wrong? You come up with that new TTP and it's like your baby. And we always joke, Ryan and I joke, like, you got to think of that movie Heat back in the day. It's like, never hold on to something, you won't drop in 30 seconds if the heat's around the corner. Like, never hold on to anything you innovate, because it's good for that thing, maybe. But don't try and bring it into this mission set and think it's a cure-all, because it never is. And if nothing else, you should feel psychotically uncomfortable with a subterranean movement. And they're coming more and more. And, the one thing I would say, too, is if you can get visuals of maybe when, if you are dealing with a threat that's moving in and out of these things, is to get some sort of ISR, some sort of area, anything with them moving. Because what's interesting is there's in a couple of countries, it's very common to where there'll be holes dug down periodically in Lexan, literally like a Lexan polycarbonate type of thing on the outside that gets covered up, but it's in there when they're working. So they have natural light that's going. Yeah. And just remember, like, any of those things you pass, it's going to be an exfil, like that's a QRF. Like, hey, if we're this far in, you're going to go move that, dig that thing out, push that side, drop a rope down, set up an anchor off your razor, whatever, and just remember, anything that you see that's displaced up there, you're going to see it dug out a little bit. It's just being very mindful and, keeping your eye on everything. But you have enough things to keep your eye on that if you had to, though, like, that's okay. That's going to be that's my last point of egress. This is going to be the last point of egress. You can't, situational awareness, spatial awareness is an understatement for the amount of things that have been going through your head, but that's really vital. Is something, all shit goes wrong. How are we getting that casualty out, or how are we getting out really, really quick? And there was quite a few in the Sierra area, things like that they're dug out, like sand is on top. And when guys have gone through them, those have been cleared. Unfortunately, a lot of times they're going through at night. But be mindful, see if you can get something, some sort of intel on that place during the day, and see if you can spot any of those, because those are all extraction points.
Mm-hmm. Cool. If you would, and people want to chase down you for training or just asking questions, tell us about your website, how they can find you.
Yeah, you can hit me up. This is hysterical, but elementrescue.com. And we have a whole backside of our website, too, that has a lot more information, libraries of data, just like what you're saying. We run into with a lot of groups that has SOPs for whether it's vertical, whether it's lifting, whether it's collapse structure, whatever, that do not meet reality one bit. And it's actually been disproven. They just haven't kept up with the times of things. And so we have an entire library of all peer-reviewed documents, whether that's from ITERS or various research papers with actual data, things you'd expect from medicine, but in rescue. Going through all the way from, you know, using vehicles and tankers to the, you know, shrubs that look like they're dead in the Colorado Plateau, how to use those for anchor strengths and things. So we try, and whenever we teach, I always kind of start off with, everything that comes out of my mouth, unless I say so, and explicitly tell you, I've got data to support, exactly what we're teaching. If I don't, I will tell you, and I will tell you, if we get to that point where we're talking about that, then I will tell you when we've used it and where specifically we have not used it under what circumstances that I'd be cautious of until that data is out there. Because I'd much rather everything in rescue, I think is maybe like back in the day, like with ditch medicine type of stuff, like with the old tampons and it's all opinion. And that's really a big thing in rescue, is it's all opinion. So I don't want you to argue with me. I want you to argue with data and science. Hey, you buy whatever you think, man, that's cool. But like, you're not getting shitty with me. You're getting shitty with research. Yeah. And that's kind of the way I prefer to do that. And it allows us to push limits, to do things that people are like, holy shit, man, like I never knew we could even do this. Until you realize, oh my God, yeah, this is actually safer than the other stuff, and it's efficient, it's fast, and it's so much easier. And the second you bring something complicated, like rescue is made so complicated, and in many cases, it does not have to be ever that complicated. There's a few principles from a safety standpoint, but in the end, you know, it is psychotically easy, and it's something that should be in everybody's, I hate the toolbox metaphor, but it should be in everybody's back pocket to be able to rock the mic on. And so we, behind the scenes, we have literally thousands of papers and studies and PowerPoints with the data and the research and the testing of all these things. And some of them are pretty surprising, and some of them kind of make sense, but it's an asset for anybody that needs them, especially if they're fighting with command. Yeah. And that's what I love, is I'm not like, oh, you know, fight the power type of thing with command or whatever, like, you know, but what I am saying is, this is usually if I get resistance from a command, like, hey, I saw what you're teaching those guys, like, this is what we teach. You know, I say, try and say very respectful of that, and be like, hey, you know, here's what I taught, and it's here's the data, here's the 7 studies from different groups coming to the same conclusion on that. I'd be super interested in seeing your data that you have your TTPs written off of, just to see where this, like, where the variables were in research, like, did they not do this here or whatever? And that's probably happened maybe close to 100 times in the past decade or whatever. And no one has ever been able to produce data ever, you know, and we don't see it in medicine. Why do we see it in rescue? Can be just as lethal. And
that's right.
And so I'm a big proponent. And when we combine that into a casualty management, the person I'm doing medicine on is the person I'm moving vertically. It's the person I'm moving in a collapse. It's the person I'm, you know, so you're vulnerable when you blindly follow things that actually have been proven wrong 10 years ago in some cases that we still see in current TTPs on SOCOM units.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like the jock strap, man. Like, you know, like I'm here to support you, man. And so a lot of that from a call. But yeah, and on there, just hit like info at Element Rescue. It'll go to Julie. She'll throw it to me and we'll talk, man. Just give me a call, whatever the case may be. And then I don't sleep. So it doesn't matter time of day, you're in Japan, you're wherever. Like, let's do this thing. I'm in. Cool. I like problems.
Nice. Well, thank you, Sean. I really appreciate it.
Last thing, I've got to do this. Last thing is, over all of this stuff, we talked about knowing all the equipment, ins and outs, this and that, is I got to quote a good friend of mine who I respect enormously from when he was an assault medic. Now he's a sergeant major in USASOC, medics, but Matt Garrison. And he, a couple training iterations ago, we were sitting there in the middle of the night or whatever, and he threw out this thing, and I looked at him like, he's a smart dude. Like, Matt's a thinker, man. What he does is it's his craft, and I love that. But he threw out this quote, and I'm like, I'm going to quote you on that. And on top of that, I'm going to bring it into rescue also. But his basic quote was, a medic's primary weapon system are the drugs in my mind. You must be an expert with it. Understand each use, contraindication, dose, profile, off-label uses, etc., and train and practice with it continually. You don't walk into a house with a gun that you've never used, never zeroed, or know the dope on. So why would you ever treat a mate with a drug that I know nothing about, or that I'm uncomfortable with using, or could cause more harm with? It just doesn't make any sense. And that was him just BSing as we were drinking like monsters in the middle of the night, trying to stay awake. And I thought that was pretty profound, especially when we talk about even bringing that into the full spectrum casualty management, not just with a medic and those drugs, but, you know, from the nine different things on prolonged field care to rescue to those things is we see that a lot, right? With people like good idea fairies that'll come out. And I get that, man, you're improv and you got nothing. You know, like, you know, basically, you know, ghetto kids, man, skateboarding, dirty ghetto kids, like came from nothing. There's times where you're just gonna pull that out. But have that game going to where it's like, boom, I can tell you 15 things I can do with that Halmatro hand pump. I can tell you 15 things I can do with that freaking high lift jack. And it's not even a alternate contingency. Like, that's my primary when it comes to passenger vehicle extrication. Like, you grab any Halmatro tools you want, any Sawzalls you want, probably going to be able to beat you, like, not close, with nothing but a high lift jack. Taking doors, TPN roofs, moving dashboards with just a high lift jack. And how easy is that thing to use? Yeah. So just knowing your shit inside, like whatever's in your mobility package, every secondary tertiary use for that, everything that's in here, everything that's over here, finding other uses for it and innovating, and then just trying to tinker with it every chance you get. Even if you think it's going to fail, it's usually those ones where you're like, listen, guys, this is probably not going to work. It's going to look stupid. I just got to try this. And all of a sudden you're just like, holy shit, did that just work? And innovate your own rescue that fits your team, your capability, your mission set. It fits into that. It's not trying to get a square into a circle peg hole, which we see all the time. Like, make it yours, own that shit. You don't have to fucking do rescue all the time, which will bring us to hopefully a podcast you may do with Taylor Jolly one of these days, that you will freaking love. And the last thing I tell people too is, as far as improvisation, it's also considered negative in some contexts. There's a book called Expert. Last name, it's a UK surgeon. Last name is Kneebone, as funny as that is. Get the Audibles, get the Kindle, get the hardback, whatever. It's called Expert. Incredible book, but really focus on the chapter where he goes into detail on improv. And he's like, every surgeon, those that tell you that they don't improv every single surgery just aren't good enough to tell you that they just don't know that there should be improving. They're trying to do what was taught to them into it. It's probably not the fitting thing. Get really comfortable with improving just by knowing a couple of the principles, and then just rock the mic, man.
Cool. Well, Sean, again, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, man. You guys do God's work, man. You take it easy.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Great boy is waiting there for you.